Wanted, Eugene Cunningham, the Project Gutenberg ebook of Wanted. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org if you are not located in the United States. You will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. Title: Wanted, Author: Eugene Cunningham. Release date: September 3, 2025. Ebook 76804. Language: English. Original publication: New York, Doubleday, Page & Co., 1927. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/76804. Credits: Roger Frank and Sue Clark. Asterisk start of the project GUTENBRGEBOOKWANTD? Asterisk frontispiece, Wanted, by Eugene Cunningham, author of Beginner's Luck, The Hermit of Tigerhead Butte, etc. A bullet 6 inches from his head warned Ware's kid that he was warmer in his search for the killer of F. Carson, but even then he did not suspect how soon he was to reach the surprising end of the long trail. Ware's kid jogged into Dallas, coming from Austin pursuant to special orders of the adjutant general, which covered the proposed capture or burial of one Del Spreen, who was charged with murder and robbery down El Paso way. Horsemen passed him, farmers in wagons with their families about them. All gave the smallish figure on the black stallion a more than usually curious glance. He was dressed like a Mexican dandy, a huge black sombrero, heavy with silver bullion, shading a lean brown face and sun-narrowed gray-green eyes, a waist-length jumper of soft-tanned goatskin, fringed from shoulder to elbow and with a bouquet of scarlet roses embroidered upon the back, pantaloons of blue with rows of twinkling silver buttons on each side of the crimson insert in the outer seam. Some of those who passed him would have instantly recognized his name, for he had wiped out Black Alec Rawls's gang 2 years before and so had marked his entry into the Rangers. The tale was a classic over a wide land. But the crowd passed on unwittingly, for his white-handled Colt hung awkwardly high upon his belt, and the canny readiness of sleek, brown Winchester stock to his hand was not readily apparent. Two, he was obviously no more than 18 or 19 years old. On the main street, Ware's kid pulled up, this time to stare broodingly up the shallow canyon of brick and wooden buildings, almost as if he expected to see Del Spreen, a small, deadly figure of smooth, fierce brown face and murderous black eyes, step from a doorway, a drowsy idler upon a saloon porch, leaning comfortably against a post, with feet in the dust of the street, promised information. Ware's kid spurred over, and at sound of the stallion's feet, the lank one opened his eyes lazily. Sheriff's office? Inquired Ware's kid politely. Get to hell out o here and find out if you all so curus, snarled the loafer. Sheriff's office? Repeated Ware's kid. Finding icy greenish eyes boring into his face, eyes lit by an uncanny, electric sparkling, the loafer sat suddenly stiff-backed. "'Scuse me,' he cried shakily. "'But I sure thought you all was a greaser, yo, clothes and yo, yo.' Ware's kid ignored the profuse flow of apologies. Having received his directions, he rode on. The lounger mopped damp brow with a sleeve and peered after the tall black and its small rider. "'God, he's a mean N, I bet you,' he said. "'Gent what packs a six-shooter but reaches for his carbine when he's riled, I bet you he's a wolf.' Ware's kid swung down before the sheriff's office and hitched the stallion to a splintered post. With carbine cuddled in his arm, he crossed to stand in the doorway of the office. His roving eyes made out. In the duskiest corner, a small figure squatting against the wall, Ware's kid went inside. The squatting one was a boy of 15. Barefooted in faded overalls, gingham shirt, and ragged hat upon towy hair. His round eyes were of the palest blue, and he had neither brows nor lashes, so that his gaze seemed unwinking like a snake. "Sheriff," grunted Ware's kid. The boy jerked his head toward the street door and shrugged silently. Ware's kid, after a long stare, lounged over to another corner and himself squatted upon his heels. Presently he forgot the boy in the opposite corner. Slowly he produced Durham and brown papers and methodically built a cigarette. This he laid upon the floor before him and rolled another, then a third, fourth, fifth, sixth. They laid in a neat row. He picked up one from the end of the row and lit it. He wondered if he were really to find Del Spreen here in Dallas. He had not been in Carwell with Sergeant Ames on the day 3 months past, when Simeon Rudder and two Obar riders had spurred into the tiny Sleepy Village with the word of the murder and robbery of F. Carson, Rutter's partner. But the sour-faced ranger sergeant had told him of the crime and of his investigations at El Castillo, the long, low rock wall from behind which F. Carson had been shot, piecing together the testimony of Rutter and the punchers, and adding the result of his own observation, Ames had made a fairly complete story. Carson had been on his way back to the O-Bar with about $7,000 of his and Rutter's money. During his absence up Crow Point Way, this gunman Spreen had ridden up to the O-Bar and asked for Carson. Told that he was absent, Spreen had said grimly that he would wait. But shortly after breakfast on the day of the murder, while the ranch house was deserted except for two Mex cooks, Spreen had disappeared. None had since seen him. Spreen knew that Carson was to return with a large sum of money. The whole ranch had known it. Evidently, said Ames, Spreen had ridden up the Crow Point Trail to ambush him where it ran along the rock wall in the desert, El Castillo. He had not waited long. There were but two cigarette stubs in the trampled sand. F. Carson had come squarely into range of the steadied rifle. Then two shots and the wizened little cowman had sideslipped from the saddle to sprawl face downward dead. Having robbed the body, Spreen had vanished as if the ground had swallowed him. Ware's kid went over the details of his own investigation. He had located the niche in the wall which had held the murderer's .44 rifle. He had recreated the murder, had interviewed Rutter and the O-Bar boys. The dark, bitter-tongued rancher had told how he had ridden with the punchers up the trail toward Crow Point when Carson's failure to return had alarmed him. Told how they had found Carson sprawled upon the sand, found his horse a quarter mile away with bridle reins caught in the Ocotillos. 2 weeks after the murder, a peremptory summons had come to Ware's kid from headquarters in Austin. He had found the adjutant general, determined to stamp out the wave of crime then sweeping the border country. He wanted this Spreen killed or taken. Preferably the latter, that he might be hanged upon the scene of his crime. You wiped out Black Alex gang, the adjutant general had said to Ware's kid. So I'm giving you this commission, get Del Spreen. I don't care where you have to go to get him either. Ware's kid, who was now smoking the fifth cigarette from his layout, was aroused from his thoughts by footsteps. A stocky man clumped inside the office and sat down at the battered desk. Monin, nodded the stocky man. The rigidity of his angular face was broken up by curiosity, as with alert brown eyes roved over the Mexican finery. Something? Do know, shrugged Ware's kid. He noted that the man wore a deputy sheriff's badge upon his open vest. He was perhaps 29 or 30, though dark mustache and tiny. Goatee made him seem older. He was dusty as from long riding. Now he reached down stiffly and took off his spurs. Do know, repeated Ware's kid. Sheriff. Sheriff's up to Austin, apowowin' with the governor. Art. Willick Art's chief diptai, he's ramblin' round the Ellen Bottoms, Denton Way huntin' Sam Bass. Mention of the notorious outlaw, who was just then keeping rangers and peace officers frantic, solved a part of Ware's kid's puzzle. He had been wondering whether or not to take the local officers into his confidence, tell them frankly whom he sought. He decided to forgo any help these Easterners could give in locating Spreen, an East Texas man and perhaps one known to them, to gain the greater advantage of working without danger of warning being passed to Spreen by some friend. Kind-o interested in Bass, he told the deputy thoughtfully. Ranger, headquarters troop. Name's Ware. Ware, cried the deputy, staring hard and somewhat unbelievingly. Heard about you all, glad to meet you. He shook hands and sat down again, still eyeing Ware's kid doubtfully. Then the boy in the corner came silently to the desk. The deputy nodded to him, hesitated, and turned to Ware's kid. Mind if I talk to him, private? He asked apologetically. Ware's kid went outside to lean against the wall. He could hear the boy, excited, whispering, an occasional explosive grunt from the deputy. Then he was called inside. The boy was gone. The deputy sat scowling down at the desk, tap-tapping the curving black butt of the long-barreled Colt at his hip. He glanced up at Ware's kid, with the odd, appraising stare he had given the small figure at first, mention of his name. My name's Bose Johnson, he remarked abruptly. You all make Yosef too, home here, I'll be back right soon. He was gone 15 or 20 minutes, and when he came in again, his face wore that expression of grim rigidity which Ware's kid had marked upon him when first he had come into the office. All right, he grunted. Let's get yo haws to the stable, then I'll buy you all a drink. They saw to the stallion's stabling, then crossed the street to a low, brick saloon. There were not many in it, a cowboy or two, a knot of farmers standing together far down the bar. But drinking alone was a huge man with sullen, red face and close-set black eyes. he turned at. The pair's entrance, staring. "Whiskey," said Bose Johnson tonelessly. Ware's kid nodded agreement, the big man watched, tugging at long mustaches and snorting loudly as if at his private thoughts. He watched belligerently while the bartender poured the drinks for Ware's kid and Bose Johnson. "Bartender," he bellowed suddenly and crashed a huge fist upon the polished bar. "Yes, sir," replied the bartender. His pasty face was gray-hued. "Yes, sir. You all know who I am, bartender. I ask you all, don you all know what I am, huh? Yes, sir, Mr. Branch, course I do. Everybody knows Bull Branch, so do." Bull Branch continued to glare menacingly at him. "Bartender," he growled. "Since when is Mexicans load to come a shovin' in your a drinkin' with white men? You all get down there and take the tear drink away from that Mex. Then you all chase him out. Here for I get mad." Slowly the bartender inched toward Ware's kid, who had not yet seemed even to glance in Bull Branch's direction. When he was still 6 feet away, the ranger turned his head a trifle and regarded the bartender. The unhappy man stopped instantly, shrinking back before the uncanny, electric sparkling in the gray-green eyes. Slowly then, Ware's kid wheeled to face Bull Branch. "Where I come from," thus the ranger in a soft drawl, "ever gent kills his own snakes." "What?" roared Bull Branch, lowering big head on bull neck and glaring ferociously. "What? Pop yo whip, fella?" Ware's kid invited him, still in the bored drawl. Bull Branch gaped amazedly. Deliberately, he pushed back his coat flaps and put huge hands upon his hips. The pearl-gripped butts of two colts showed almost under his fingers. Then he bore slowly down upon the ranger, who stood sideway to the bar with left elbow resting on its edge. Bose Johnson moved unobtrusively away from the bar and out of possible line of fire. But Bull Branch made no move to draw his guns, merely came on ponderously. What followed was blurred like the action of a rattler's head as it strikes. The left hand of Ware's kid moved, so rapidly that none there actually saw it move. It caught up the whiskey glass from the bar and flipped the stinging liquor squarely into Bull Branch's face. As the huge figure reeled, hands going to tortured eyes, Ware's kid shot forward. He twitched Branch's colts from their holsters and hurled them into a corner. He rained blows upon Bull Branch's face, leaping clear off the floor to reach that height. It was cat and mastiff. Blindly, Bull Branch tried to push him off, but those hard fists, landing with force terrifically out of proportion to the small body behind them, cut his face to ribbons, closed his eyes to puffy-lidded slits, drove sickeningly into his midsection. He staggered about the barroom, grunting, whining, helpless. At last, some instinct seemed to show him the door. He broke for it at a staggering run, and Ware's kid, with a Comanche yell, leaped upon his back and spurred him through it, catching hold of the lintel and swinging down to the floor. As Bull Branch lurched through and fell sprawling upon the veranda floor. Side. When he came back, the bartender was half crouched against the back bar, with eyes bulging. Bose Johnson and the other patrons were clinging to the bar, some whooping feebly, others too weak to do more than shed happy tears. Bose Johnson waggled a hand at the bartender. "Set him up, bartender," he gasped. "This ends on the house. Where Meb, they won't neve heistee no monument to you all here, but Bull Branch, he'll remembe you all plenty." Back in the sheriff's office, Johnson turned suddenly serious again. He sat staring at the wall, his harsh face rigid as if set in bronze. "I got you all into that trouble with Bull Branch," Johnson said suddenly. "Done it a purpose." Ware's kid merely waited, brown face, gray-green eyes, revealing nothing of his thoughts. "Wondered if you all really was wherein, if you was, how much o' the talk was so, because I sure do need some help. Fur what? To go out with me tonight and stand up to Sam Bass's gang?" Ware's kid studied the grimly earnest face. From the beginning, he had sensed something unusual about him. He thought that Johnson was usually a happy-go-lucky cowpuncher and a man efficient with either hands or weapons. He was used to judging men quickly, and he began to like this stocky deputy. "A right," he grunted curtly. "You all willin'," cried Johnson. "Then here's the layout. They're goin' to stick up the eastbound T&P agin at Eagle Ford. Figure folks won't be expectin' lightnin' to hit twict in the same place. Me and you will be in the weeds long the track. How come just us two?" "I could raise a posse," Johnson admitted. "But how am I going to know? The fellas I line up ain't in with Bass, no. I'm going to line my sights on Simp Dunbar, and before I let some damn spy carry word, I'll go it by myself. Simp Dunbar, who's he? He's the skunk that killed my cousin, Billy Tucker, 2 weeks ago ove in Tarrant. Man, I'd give a black land farm to get me Simp Dunbar ove my front sight, and I sure will." T was like this. Bass's outfit loped up to a saloon on the Age O Fort Worth, where Billy, he was having a drink. There was some kind o' wranglin', Billy Bain, the kind as won't back down fur no man livin'. Simp Dunbar, I've knowed him all my life. Fur a useless cuss and Billy knowed him, too, he shot from off to one's side. Billy and me, we held around Tojthay when we was kids. Punched. Cows Tojthay out Menard way, I thought a heap o' Billy. Where's kid nodded silently. Here was a man he understood. Understood his vindictiveness, for it was in his own fierce Texan blood, understood his willingness to take 100-to-1 chance to face his enemy. More and more he liked Bose Johnson. A right, we'll hunt him up, he grunted. How come ya know they're goin' to be at Eagle Ford? My spy told me. Had him a-watchin' fur 'em last 2 weeks. That boy. Where's kid stared silently at Johnson. What's name that other little station, East O'Here? He asked. Mesquite. Didn't even know there was one, shrugged Where's kid with a ghost of a grin. Johnson will be at Mesquite, not Eagle Ford, tonight. Boys lyin' in with Bass, likely, feelin' I got, and mostly my feelin' is right. Johnson was won over to acceptance of the altered plan, if but half-willingly. He admitted that he knew nothing much of the boy who had appeared in the office a month before offering to spy upon the Bass gang. In with Bass, repeated the ranger. Hell, he could have brought you lots, oh news, for this. They waited until nearly dark, then ate at a Chinese restaurant. It was pitch dark when they went swiftly to the stable where Johnson's horse, with the big stallion, had been fed an hour before. They saddled, talking a little for the benefit of any ears that might be stretched toward them of the western road, that toward Eagle Ford. For a couple of miles, they rode swiftly eastward, then turned south on, the road to Mesquite. They were close to the railroad always, riding through woodland. Johnson led because of his knowledge of the country. Soon he checked his mount and jerked the Winchester from its scabbard. Where's kid already cuddled his carbine in the crook of his arm. They rode on again, slower now. Suddenly, not 50 yards ahead, a man scratched a match. The ranger jerked his carbine up. Gently he kneed the stallion around, feeling. Rather than seeing, that Johnson was doing likewise. There was no alarm, while they moved back 100 yards and slipped off their animals. Let's hitch the hawses and sneak up, whispered Johnson. They returned to the point from which they had seen the flare of that match, the stocky deputy making no more sound than a shadow than the ranger himself. Then they halted, squatting on their heels, to listen. There was the sound of men moving, of horses, the hum of low-voiced, jerky conversation. Late again. A boyish voice complained. Hell, you'd think we were passengers, Sam, way the damn railroad's treating us. Don't ye fret, bub, a harsh voice answered the youngster. She'll be a ramblin' along right soon. Engineer, he'll see that log and he'll jerk her back onto her tail right sudden. Everybody lined up? Inquired a pleasant voice, Bass's, Where's kid, surmised. Y'all know where y'all work. As the voices answered in affirmative grunts, the ranger began moving. Soundlessly to circle them to get nearer to the point where the train would stop. Johnson followed until they were squatting in a little open, perhaps 50 feet from the track, sheltered by a fallen tree. You all was sure right, breathed Johnson. Wouldn't be nowheres else in the world. Minutes ticked off, then there was the sound of the train, far away. The rails before them began to hum. The train was upon robbers and officers, with a roar. Came a frantic squealing of brakes and the scream of the whistle. The train had barely halted when there was a rattle of shots along the track. It was so dark that there was no clue to the robbers' positions, save the orange flames that stab-stabbed the night. Where's kid was, conscious that Johnson was gone from beside him. He wasted no time, thinking of that, but ran crouched over up to the track where he could fire at the robbers' shot flashes. From here he went into action with coldly precise fire from the carbine. Who's that damn jughead? Someone roared. Evidently, thought where? Kid, he was believed to be some misguided member of the gang, firing into his own people. From between the cars came shots to answer the gang now. It was pandemonium there in the pitchy night with the heavy roar of Colts and the sharp, whip-like reports of rifles. A man could but guess by the relative positions of the flashes at whom he shot. The ranger hardly expected to do much execution. His position made that a matter of chance. But he was worrying the Bass men. Suddenly a high, clear voice rang out, crying a name over and over, again penetrating even the staccato din of the firing. Simp Dunbar, where you all? Simp Dunbar, a voice answered, but there was no diminution in the firing. Where's kid crawled down the track, having reloaded his carbine. With his first shot, a man cried out shrilly. He pumped the lever and his carbine jammed. He spat a bitter curse. He knew instantly what had happened. He had slipped a .45 pistol cartridge into a .44 carbine. A huge shape hurled itself at him. Mechanically, he threw up his carbine, and the oncoming man ran into it. Then Ware's kid, tugging at the butt of his seldom-used colt, leaped aside. A roar sounded almost in his ear. Then a hand caught his shoulder. Instinctively, he stepped close to his assailant, turned like a flash when a pistol brushed him, dropped his colt and caught the fellow's gun hand with both of his and hung on, grimly. "Something's wrong, boys. Let's get out, oh, you're." A cool, half-laughing voice was shouting down the track, not the voice which had called Simp Dunbar's name. The fellow with whom Ware's kid grappled was swinging terrific blows at his lighter opponent. But the ranger's head was against his chest. The big fellow's fists but grazed their mark. But he was tiring with his bulldog grip on the other's gun hand. Suddenly, he released his hold and tried to leap backward. A heel caught on a bunch of grass and he stumbled. A flash and roar from in front of him, a stinging pain across his head. He crashed flat. He came to, conscious of a dull headache and next of a dim light over his head. After a moment of blinking, he perceived that he was sitting in a chair of a railway coach. Next, he realized that the train was moving. "How do you all feel now?" inquired an anxious voice. Painfully, he turned his head and saw Bose Johnson's worried face opposite him. "Right puny," he grunted truthfully. Johnson grinned widely, relief in his brown eyes. "What happened?" demanded Ware's kid. "Bullet creased you all. You all been picking daisies might nigh a hour. The hell where we goin', gang getaway? Goin' into Dallas. Yeah, gang hightailed it, all but Simp Dunbar," said Johnson. "Reckon they'll most all be a-lickin' some sore spots, though. Me and you all did right smart o-shootin'. I hollered fur Simp and like, a damn jughead," he spoke right up. "I snuck up onto him and told him who I was." He lifted his arm and in the loose flannel of his shirt beneath it, showed a great hole with charred edges. "Might nigh got me first crack, but I worked buttonholes up and down, his front four he could shoot agin. How come ya found me?" "By looking around," shrugged Johnson affectionately. "You damn red-eyed, lil runt, you all think I'd hike out and leave you all out there. Summers, fur the gang meb to find, I come runnin' up about the time. You all tumbled, see that hairpin right on top me, and me with an empty gun, I yelled like a Comanche and damned if he never broke and run." Ware's kid eyed him steadily. He knew that only Johnson's arrival had kept his assailant from putting another bullet into him as he lay, unconscious. He leaned back wearily in the seat. Johnson stretched his bowed legs comfortably and took off his Stetson. "Wished I had a chaw," he grumbled. "Got the Mackin." Ware's kid fumbled in his jumper pocket. "Don't use her that away. I never could learn to smoke some way." He threw his head back and closed his eyes. And the ranger, watching him, turned suddenly cold all over. For upon the brown, sinewy neck that had been always hidden heretofore by the silken neckerchief shone a long white scar that stretched evenly three quarters of the way around it, a stocky, dark-faced, dark-eyed man with a white scar circling evenly around his neck, so Simeon Rudder and the Obar hands had described Del Spreen. True, they had seen him clean-shaven, and believing him guilty of murder, they remembered his features and eyes as murderous. But there was no doubt about it. Del Spreen sat there across from him with closed eyes. And to Del Spreen he owed his life that night. "Del Spreen," he called in a low voice. Boss Johnson moved like a cat to half-draw his colt. Then he saw the derringer that covered him with twin barrels. For an instant he hesitated, then shoved the colt back into its holster and slumped. "So you all come after me," he said. "I been looking for somebody to show up. That's why I got me a job as dip tie. Figured whoever come to spill his tail in the office and seeing me wearing a badge wouldn't suspicion me, especially since I never used my own name in the Obar country, but you all sure fooled me. Hate like hell to do it," Ware's kid wriggled miserably. "But I'm a ranger. Do anything I can to help ya, Johnson, much as I do for my own blood kin. But I got to take ya back. I ain't blaming you all, but might's well shoot me right now as to put me up for a jury in that country. Everything against me specially bane a strange. That's why I hightailed it soon's I heard he'd been found. I ain't denying I went to the Obar fig jarin I'd meb have to kill Carson. I was going to get back the money he stole off my brothian, siste. Going to get it back or try the case before Judge Colt. But if I'd killed him, it'd been from the front. He'd have been give a chanked to fill his hand. Yeah, you mean you never killed him?" cried Ware's kid. Then the old surge of hope died. Of course Johnson would say that. "D you all figure me that away, knowin' no more about me than you do?" Johnson asked. Slowly the ranger shook his head. "Looky yer," argued the deputy. "F Carson and my brothe, Sam, they was ranchin' it ove on the Brazos. Carson's a tough homber. Remember, he's gamblin' a lot. Well, he sells ever last head o' stuff on the place while Sam's down in Fort Worth. Time Sam gets back with my kid siste that's got a share in the ranch, Carson's done gambled away the money. These a row o' course. Sam, he's got more guts than gun sense. Carson nigh kills him. Time I come into it, Carson's rattled his hocks. 2 years after I'm ridden down in the El Paso country. Hear about F, Carson O the O-bar. I go hightailin' at Ove and hang around 4 or 5 days, but Carson, don't come. Then I start out Fur Crow Point a-huntin' him. Then, hell-bent, comes the Max Cook's helper boy. I kept a cowboy from beatin' him to death one day. Says Carson's killed and robbed-in. Everybody says I must have killed him. Well, what do I do? Try to tell them red-eyed O-bar boys as how I was intendin' to kill F. Carson, Meb, but Neve got no chanked? Like hell, I figure the job I come to do is done. I leave that air country in a mile-high cloud o' dust. Where's kid slumped lower in the seat, going over and over his mental? Picture of the scene of the crime. Boss, Johnson rose to cup his hands against the window glass and peer out into the night. Missing no slightest movement of his prisoner, the ranger studied again the wide, powerful shoulders, the handy legs of the man who has ridden almost since birth. Johnson turned slowly. Dallas, be in soon, he said. Then I ain't blammin' you all none, where, but just well sort o' between us. I wished I could make you, believe I never done it, I sort o' took to you all from the beginnin', and t ain't a bit o' use, interrupted Ware's kid. A tiny smile was born far back in the gray-green eyes, seemed to spread over the habitually blank brown face and come finally to rest upon the thin-lipped mouth. T ain't a bit o' use, he repeated. Cause I know ya never done it. Ostentatiously, he returned the derringer to his jumper pocket. All right, Bose. Ya got to go down to Austin with me. Got to exhibit ya some to the adjutant general to make him sabe, but that'll be all. Listen, I went snoopin' around some myself down at Carwell. Found where the fella that killed F. Carson had waited. Point one, there was 2 brown cigarette stubs on the ground. Y'all say ya don't smoke, and these no stain on yo fingers. I found where this fella stood with his rifle in a sort o' notch. His footprints was still pretty plain. Well, yo feet bows point in like a pigeon. This fella's showed in the soft dirt under the rock, overhang a pointin' out, but point three's the big N. I stand 5'7", and that notch, he rested his Winchester in was level with my eyes. Short as yo all are, it'd be mighty near over yo head. Now, he never stood on nothin', cause the ain't nothin' they to stand on. And he never fired from no saddle. Cause I found where his haws'd been tied back in the brush. Man, but you all sure wipe some cold sweat off me, cried Bose, Johnson. I knowed I neve done it, but provenit the way you all just done neve would've come to me, I reckon. Took a bigger man than Ari one of us. That's what we're going to show the adjutant general. Then I'm going to ask him to let me go back to Carwell to find the fella that really done the killin'. He'll let me go, and if he does, cried Bose, Johnson very earnestly, man, these sure some. 6 foot-a's down in that Carwell country as'll be up in the air 2 ways, to onct. Up out of the glaring yellow sand, the long, low, narrow barrier of black rock jutted abruptly. El Castillo, the castle, the Mexicans had named it long ago. The name such names fitted as well as such names usually do. Actually, it more resembled a stone fence 50 yards long, which, in height, varied from 3 to 10 feet and in thickness from a foot to 4, even 5 feet. The top was jagged, sharp saw teeth of slick, inky rock. A sinister pile, even in the white sunlight of a desert forenoon. Ware's kid squatted on spurred heels at the castle's western end, where the trail forked to run on either side of the wall. Not much of a trail, this, the deep, loose, perpetually drifting sand soon effaced. Impressions, but generations of travel had made a lane between walls of greasewood and catclaw and cactus. It was near the ranger's position, on this dimly marked track, that F. Carson had died, shot from the saddle without a chance to return the murderer's fire, having left Del Spreen in the care of the adjutant general in Austin, and returned swiftly to Carwell, where's kid had come without being observed to the scene of the murder. Now that he knew Spreen had not committed the killing, he must decide who did. Satisfied the adjutant general Spreen neve done it, reflected the ranger. But I got to figure out who did. Spreen's too little. Good size. Homber plugged F. Carson. He got up and the great black stallion which had stood behind him as he squatted now followed like a dog to the spot where F. Carson, murderer, had lain in wait. Where's kid knew the place well. Fella leaned up against the rock right here, he reenacted the scene mentally. Lined his sights on Carson. Carson was common up T other side from over Crow Point way. Fella drilled him plumb center, went out, and took 7,000 out o' Carson's saddlebags, stood right here. Standin' on the ground, no hoss tracks closin' that catclaw yonder. Good size, fella, had to be to rest his rifle in that crotch. Mechanically he studied the rock wall and the sand that swept away from its foot, something bright in the sand in the very spot where they had found the murderer's tracks. He stooped, but it was only a glassy bit of rock. He held it, staring absently, his mind upon the mystery. From the little sand dunes behind him to northward came the flat, vicious report of a rifle. A bullet slapped the rock wall almost in his face. It had passed within 6 inches of his head. Instantly, another followed. Ware's kid moved like a rattler striking. He moved automatically, but with a precision and economy of movement that could not have been bettered by rehearsals times without number. He was sheltered from the bullets within 2 steps, standing behind his stallion's bulk. His hand slapped the saddle horn. He was in the saddle without touching stirrups and lying flat upon the black's neck. The great rowels dug the stallion's flanks. He surged forward magnificently. Within 2 strides, he was galloping. The ranger, chased by bullets that buzzed spitefully about his ears, swung the black around the end of the castle. Halfway down the length of the stone wall, he slid the stallion to a halt. Here was a place where he could peer across the top between 2 teeth of rock. His great sombrero hung down his back by the chin strap. From the scabbard beneath the left fender had leaped a sleek Winchester carbine. He cuddled the carbine in the crook of his arm as, with green-gray eyes squinting coldly, he studied the sand dunes behind which his antagonist lay hidden. A thin smoke cloud was drifting upward above the dunes. Where's Kid rested the carbine in the crotch of the wall top. He sighted carefully and drove 3.44s to dust along the crest of the dunes, some 15 inches apart. Instantly, the other rifleman replied with a rolling quartet of bullets that bunched most efficiently beneath the ranger. Carbine muzzle, he watched narrowly without replying in kind. At last he shrugged and whirled the stallion to ride off south and east toward the Obar ranch house. He could have stalked the sand dunes from which the unknown bushwhacker had fired. There was cover of a sort up to the very base of the dunes, but the ambusher's fire had been entirely too craftsmanlike, too nearly deadly, to make the prospect of scaling the low slope before him seem anything but the brief preliminary to a funeral. Where's Kid preferred to ride off with a whole skin and calculate upon another meeting under conditions more equal. They said of him in the Rangers that for a youngster no more than 19, he had a mighty level head. A half mile, perhaps, he galloped without turning. Then, reaching for the field glasses, he checked the stallion. Far behind him, a horseman streaked it eastward. The ranger studied rider and brown horse through the glasses. Meb he's tall, he grunted at last. But Meb he's just a forkin, a little pony. For 10 miles, he kept the stallion at a mile-leading running walk. He had never been at the Obar house, but he knew its location from hearsay. And so, when the black began climbing a steady incline, studded by boulders and covered with taller-than-ordinary mesquite, he nodded to himself. This was the way, all right. The stallion made the incline's top and paused for a moment, expelling its breath in a great snort. At the sound, the flaxen-haired girl on the lookout rock turned sharply. She and Ware's kid stared one at another, her great dark eyes meeting his narrowed gaze levelly. Howdy, he drawled after a to him long and uncomfortable silence. He was always ill at ease with women. They usually wanted a man to make some sort of damned fool of himself to suit a feminine whim. Good morning, she replied, still examining him calmly. Trail to the Obar, he grunted awkwardly after another silence. Yes, the house is a mile away. But there's nobody there except the cook and his helper. Do you want to see my father, Sim Rudder? Where's Kid stared. He recalled nothing about a daughter on the Obar, and that Simeon Rudder, huge, gaunt, black-haired, black-eyed, black-bearded, grim and taciturn, should have such a daughter as this. Slim, fair-skinned creature seemed somehow unbelievable. She seemed to read his thoughts. I've been away at school, Les Crucis, convent, you know, she enlightened. But I'm not going back, I hope. Stay here, huh? I hope not, this is just as bad. Oh, I hate this bare, desolate country, don't you? Don't know, shrugged Ware's kid. He had never thought about the matter one way or the other. Don't know as I do. I want to go back east, to New York, Philadelphia, Boston, oh, all the places I've read about. Europe, too. I'm trying to get my father to sell the ranch and go traveling with me all over the world. I've been trying to persuade him for 2 years, but I think he'll do it now, maybe. His partner was killed, you know. He's all broken up over that. He doesn't say much, but it was an awful blow just the same. I think he'll sell out. Got to be going, grunted Ware's kid. All this talk of travel was over his head. Nor had it anything to do with his particular business, the capture of F. Carson's murderer. I'll ride with you. Will you get my horse? He's tied to a catclaw over yonder. The ranger got the pony and brought it back. He sat his stallion, holding her animal's reins. She waited for an instant, but he was blind to her expectation that he would help her into the saddle. So she swung up unaided and jerked the reins from his hand as they rode almost stirrup to stirrup toward the ranch house where Kid studied her covertly from beneath half-lowered sombrero brim. It dawned upon him suddenly that not yet had he seen her smile. The large, blue eyes were somber always, she seemed to brood upon something. They rode in silence until a half mile or so ahead, the clutter of buildings, which constituted the O-bar holding showed against the desert shrubbery. "I hate it," she burst out. "Oh, how I hate it!" Then they rode on silently again, the creak of saddle leather, the scuffing of the animals' hoofs, the only sound until they dismounted in the ranch yard. There was but one horse in the cottonwood log corral, a black gelding as large as the Mount of Ware's Kid. The girl glanced at it, then toward the house. "My father's home," she said tonelessly. "Come in." They went around the house and upon the rough veranda that shaded its front found Simeon Rudder with feet cocked upon the rail, big shaggy head upon his chest. He looked up at the sound of their footsteps and sun-narrowed black eyes softened amazingly as he saw his daughter. "Hello, baby," he rumbled. "Wonderin' where ya was." Then to where? "Kid, howdy, kid. What are ya doin' down here, Agin? Thought they sent ya up to Austin or Summers." "Did. But sent me back. I got Del Spreen." "Ya did. That's sure good hearin', kid." He came swiftly to his feet, with great hands hard clenched. The girl had gone indoors and bitterly, yet with a certain grim repression, Simeon Rudder cursed Del Spreen. "Where's Spreen now?" he demanded, breaking off suddenly. "Carwell, El Paso, Austin, lookin' up more evidence." Simon Rudder cursed the law's dawdling ways, its coddling of an assassin. "Where's Kid?" but half listened. He was thinking of the efficient rifleman of the morning who had bushwhacked him from the sand dunes. "How many big men in this country?" he asked abruptly. "Big men?" Rudder stopped short to stare at him. Then he considered the question, eyes narrowed thoughtfully. "Don't know, me, o' course. And Curly Gonzalez over Crow Point way, Lamson that crazy puncher on the D5, and Slim Nichols on the fly-in, all I think of. Why?" The ranger hesitated. Knowing Rudder's bitterness toward Del Spreen, he wondered if the dour ranchman could be made to believe his own theory, that Spreen had not, could not have, committed the murder. Wondered, too, if Rudder would be silent about the theory. "Spreen says he never killed Carson," he said slowly. "Yeah, and what? And if he did, well, I don't know how he done it. What are ya driven at? Ya got the name O'Bane, level-headed kid, but what are ya driven at? How could a little fella, littler'n me, shoot Carson, restin his gun?" A crotch near as high as he could reach. Scowling, Simeon Rudder considered this problem. "That was a high crotch, one that we found his tracks under," he admitted. "But hell, he was sittin' on a hoss or else standin' on somethin'. Not good enough, kid, by God, not half good enough to make me believe Del Spreen never shot old F. Carson from hidden. Oh, course he denies it. Spect him to own right up. Yeah, course he'd say he never. But I been thinkin', wasn't no hoss tracks under the crotch. Nothin' to stand on. Nothin' we could see anyhow. So wondered who'd be tall enough to shoot out o' that crotch standin' on the sand. And two," he hesitated for an instant before he decided to tell of the morning. "And two, somebody bushwhacked me out at the castle today. Bushwhacked ya, what for? Who'd be a bushwhackin' ya? Don't know, fell on a dun. Good shot too, pretty good that is." "Here," cried Rudder suddenly. "Too much funny business about this. I want to see that place agin. Get yo hoss, kid. Let's take a pacer out to the castle and look around." He went swiftly down to the corral and got the lariat from his saddle. The black gelding retreated to a corner, snorting, whirling, Rudder sent, the loop spinning over its head and hauled the animal to him by sheer brute force. "So damn many hosses none gets rid enough," he rumbled irritably. "Wildern antelope, all of 'em." He saddled swiftly and swung up. Where's Kid was already mounted. They turned past the front veranda and Rudder waved to his daughter who had come outside again. He seemed another person when near her. The grim shell of him cracked and a tenderness odd in a man so apparently harsh grained showed for a moment. "Going out to El Castillo," he shouted at the girl. "Back when I get back, baby." They rode silently for miles. Rudder was one after the ranger's own, heart taciturn, efficient in his business. Staring at his companion, broad back, Where's Kid nodded approval. He thought of what the girl had said of her father's repressed sorrow over his partner's death. He could understand Rudder's vengefulness toward Del Spreen, but he hoped, before the day's end, to show the O-bar owner his error to prove that Spreen could not have murdered F. Carson. "If you're right about this hype business," Rudder growled suddenly, "I don't know what we're going to do about it. Too long ago now, not that I'm admitting ya are right, but just in case ya are, how can we find out where these fellas, Curly Gonzalez and Lamson and Nichols, was that day? Fella don't always recollect just what he was doing 3 months ago, by George." He whirled sideways in the saddle. That morning, me and August Koenig, one o' my hands was ridden noth, o' the house 9-10 mile, and we met Lamson headin for a Lazario recollect now. August and Lamson come near mixin' it. Count August he was askin' about some widder that lives in a Lazario, and Lamson flew off the handle. By George, what kind o' fellas Lamson? Inquired Where's Kid. Oh, same's most. Gits kind o' crazy spells. Been kicked on the head a long time ago by a bronc, and once in a while he flies up. But he's a good puncher, and I don't know why anybody'll think he'd shoot F. Carson. Lamson's seen trouble, seen it fair and square, through the smoke. No, oh, I wouldn't put him down for that kind o' killer. Ya found Carson right afternoon, did ya? Yeah. I got fidgety, him not common in the day I figured. So when me and August got back to the house, and F. hadn't come in yet, I took August and Yavapai Wiggins and we rode out. Found F. long about 2 o'clock, lying in the trail. 7,000 about he was packin', all gone. Mostly yo's, they say. About 4,000, Rudder nodded gloomily. But T wasn't the money, riled me so. Old F, he never knowed what hit him. Never had a chanked, nary chanked to get his six-shooter out. Like I told ya then, right after it happened. I figured Del Spreen, cause he'd hung around the ranch 3 days waitin' for F, wouldn't tell nobody what he wanted, just looked mean. And packed his cantinas and hightailed it that very mawnin. I gathered ya never found the money on him? Faux dollars, bout, shrugged Where's Kid. They came to the castle and reined in the animals on the spot where the murderer of F. Carson had waited. Silently, Simeon Rudder stared at the crotch in the rock wall in which the assassin had rested his rifle barrel. Slowly, as unwilling even now to concede weight to the theory the ranger had advanced tentatively, he nodded. Though wasn't no Hostrack's closer'n that cat claw yonder, he admitted. He swung down and pulled his Winchester from its scabbard, then moved over to the crotch in the wall. Even for one of his height, it was a strain to level the barrel with butt at shoulder. He nodded again and set the rifle down. From a shirt pocket, he brought Durham and papers and shook tobacco onto the brown leaf, somber black eyes roving. Where's Kid slipped from the saddle and came swiftly over to where Rudder stood. He stopped and dug into the sand at the rancher's feet, then straightened. What's it? Asked Rudder. It was a large, pearl-handled pocket knife, tarnished from much carrying, with 4 good blades and 1 broken blade stump. Rudder licked his cigarette, jammed it into his mouth, and took the knife from the ranger. Hand staring thoughtfully. See it before? Asked Where's Kid. Rudder shook his head. No, reckon not. Not many like that carried in this country. But somebody ought to know it. We'll ride into Carwell pretty soon. See, but right now I want to ride F. Carson's back trail. Got a itty. Meb she won't pan out. They could only guess that F. Carson had come along the regular trail and follow through the dim lane between the greasewood and cacti. They rode silently, with eyes roving from trail to skyline and back again. The afternoon wore on, evening came. To westward upthrusting hulls, jagged, fantastic, drew nearer. Hucos, grunted Rudder, and Where's Kid nodded. He knew this ancient, watering place of the desert people, red and brown and white. A good many times, with a ranger detachment from Usleta, hunting Apache sign, he had camped there. Guess we better hole up there tonight, Rudder grunted, staring across. The flat to the beginning of that welter of arroyo-cut hillocks. Maunin, we can head back to Carwell and see about that frogsticker, or we can look over some more trail. Yo, itty, queried Where's Kid. Ya said ya had one. Tell ya about it come maunin, said Rudder. Far back in the grim, black eyes lurked a shadowy amusement. Ain't quite ready to back her up, clean to the tailgate. Got anything to eat? Dried beef, tortillas, coffee, can o' plums. Dried beef and tortillas is a meal, grinned Rudder. Let's head for the tanks and camp. Better hole up in the old Butterfield station, counseled Where's Kid. Healthier'n sleepin', longside the main Tanaja. Tank, Apache don't, stick no closer to the reservation than ever, I reckon. Not so close, by God, swore Rudder. You're right, kid, them damn. Feather Dusters stops here or at Crow Springs or the Commutas, Riglar, common from Mescalero to Chihuahua. Stage station she is, we'll make it. They nodded mutual agreement and spurred the horses on through the dark. At the deserted stage station, a rude dwelling made by walling in the mouth of a natural cavern, they swung down. The ranger sniffed like a hunting dog. Some seep water up the canyon apiece, he muttered. Good enough for the hosses, but I'll take the canteen and get some real water at the tank for us. He unsaddled the black stallion and swiftly Rudder followed his example. Rudder got out the food and coffee pot from the ranger's saddle bags. While the latter, bearing a canteen, started up the canyon to the main tank. Where's Kid moved silently for all his high-heeled boots. The canyon floor was of hard-packed earth but studded with loose stones, and he placed his feet carefully. One never knew who might be using the tanks. From time immemorial, it had been one of the favorite watering places of this region. Wild animals and wild men, red and brown and white, came there furtively. He passed close along the left-hand wall, decorated with Indian pictographs and the names of pioneers, and so came to the low cavern inn, which was the spring-fed well, or tank. More cautiously than ever he moved now. The rock apron before the cavern was pitted with metate, holes where prehistoric tribes had ground their corn, rude mortars still used by the Apache who camped there. It was tricky, footing and trickier still inside, where one approached the well lip, over a stone floor worn slick as glass by countless feet. Inside the cavern mouth he squatted for a moment and listened. He heard nothing from without or within and slid his feet carefully forward, balancing himself with left hand upon a rounded slab that divided the cavern in two sections. So he was awkwardly balanced when a sinewy arm shot around his throat. From behind an A, ho, sounded in his ear. A smallish, rather insignificant-seeming figure was Ware's kid. But all, whalebone and wang leather, as the rangers who had wrestled with him remarked amazedly, 110 pounds of wiry, dashingly quick, steel-strong body. Now he moved automatically, fairly shouting, "Indians!" Sideways he whirled, and so the Apache's knife went wide in its downward drive. Back shot the ranger's head to smash into the Indian's face. It broke his, strangling hold and Ware's kid, turning half in air his feet were, sliding so, shot a vicious fist into the Apache's midriff, then had the buck by the throat and was gripping him about the body with legs closing, like scissor blades, and fending off flailing arms with elbows spread. The Apache was powerful, but before he had much opportunity to struggle, Ware's kid had banged his back head against the rock. He managed a long, loud, gasping groan. Feebly his knife hand rose. The ranger loosed the throat for an instant and fumbled for the weapon. It sliced his palm, then he seized it and buried it in the Indian's body. When the Apache was limp, wise men made very sure that Apache were really dead. The ranger stood up shakily and groped for the entrance. A stone slid down into the canyon and he hurled himself forward out of the cavern. As he gained the middle of the canyon, running like a quarter horse, there was thud after thud of feet dropping from the rocks to the hard ground. He ran on his toes, hoping that he could make camp sufficiently ahead of these fleet Indians to warn Rudder, hoping, too, that Rudder had the horses together, had not taken them out onto the flat to graze. He ran as he never had run in his life. At last he sensed the camp just ahead, and from it came a rifle shot, then another. The bullets sang past him perilously close. "It's Ware's kid," he gasped. "Injuns common? Thought ya was one of 'em," grunted Rudder with no particular alarm evident in his heavy voice. "How close?" "Right behind, no time to saddle, fork 'em bareback." He paused only to snatch his precious carbine from its scabbard on the saddle, then scooped up the bite of the lariat with which the stallion was picketed. He vaulted upon the stallion's back. Muffled sound in the darkness nearby told that Rudder was following his example. Up the canyon the darkness was suddenly punctuated in a half dozen places by orange flames. Bullets thudded into the ground, into rock, walls, around the white men. The firing was a continuous roll, its rumbling multiplied by the canyon walls. As usual, the Apache had rifles, as good as any in that country, better than those of the army. Rudder swore venomously. Ware's kid had slashed the lariat with his belt knife. Rudder, apparently, had done the same. For when the black stallion surged ahead, toward the safety of the open land, Rudder was close behind. They galloped furiously for perhaps half an hour. The moon came out and flooded the desert with a white light that reminded the ranger of Billy Canant's new fashion saloon in El Paso when the electric lights were turned on, being lighter and perhaps the better rider Ware's kid led. He had lost $100 saddle, but he was phlegmatic about that. It was all in the game. They were lucky, he especially, to be riding away with their hair. A sudden groan from Rudder aroused him from his thoughts, and he looked backward under his arm in time to see the big man slide sideways off his gelding and roll over upon his side. Mechanically, Ware's kid whirled the stallion and glared half a dozen ways at once in search of the assassin. But the broad expanse of greasewood and cacti lay quiet in the incandescent moonlight. So he rode back to Rudder and slid to the sand. "Got me," Rudder gasped. "Back yonder. Thought I could make it back to the ranch, see my girl, but let's see," grunted Ware's kid practically. He explored the blood-caked shirt front and lifted a shoulder point in a little gesture of fatalistic resignation. There was a .44 hole in Rudder's chest. How he had ridden this far was the marvel. The ranger squatted there broodingly, watching mechanically along the back trail, in case the Indians appeared. "Want me to sign a paper?" At the painful whisper, Ware's kid looked down curiously into Rudder's grim-lined face. "Sure," he nodded after a moment, thinking to humor a delirious man, "if it'll ease ya." Knowed ya had the deadwood on me when ya found my knife. But I wasn't going to let ya see Carwell Agin ever ya tried to make out ya never suspicioned. But I knowed, they've got ya for Monin. Damn near got ya yesterday Monin at the castle. Seen ya pockin. Round pick up something skeered me and I waned away. Hadn't missed wouldn't be here. Twas on the cards, I reckon. He stopped wearily, breathing in labored wheezes. Where's kid squatted beside him, staring down with expressionless face. Suddenly Rudder. Wheezes became louder, quicker. After a moment, the ranger understood that it was horrible laughter. Reckon my gal will do her travelin' now, always after me to sell out. I done for F. Carson, count o' that. None o' that money was mine, all hissin', I wanted it. His voice trailed off into incoherent mumbling. Where's kid bethought himself suddenly of what Rudder had said about signing a paper. He fumbled in his jumper pocket and found a letter of the adjutant general. The letter which had summoned him to Austin 3 months ago and so had brought him indirectly to sit here tonight. A stub of pencil was there too. "Eh, right," he snapped. "Sign the paper." He supported the murderer's head and shoulders and crooked his knee so that Rudder could lay the paper upon it. It was slow, painful work, but at last he held the curt scrawl up in the moonlight and painfully spelled it out. "Del Spreen never killed F. Carson, I done it and robbed him, Simeon Rudder." Presently Rudder died, without pain, apparently. Where's kid rolled a cigarette and lit it, staring blankly straight ahead. "He sure fooled me," he grunted admiringly. "He sure did, and like to. Killed me twicked, at the castle and tonight. He never took me for no injun. He was aimin' to down me. Just fool's luck I'm here, alivin', kickin', and with this here paper." He got up, thinking to ride for Carwell and tell his story, show the confession. Suddenly he thought of the girl, the wistful-eyed, sad-faced girl at the O'Bar ranch house. He squatted again and made another cigarette. Slowly but surely, he mulled the business over. It came to him finally that there were really but two persons to be considered: Del Spreen, sitting around the adjutant general's office up at Austin, and that girl of Rudder. Absolute vindication of Spreen was easy. The means lay in his hand here, but that would mean a blow at a girl who had had no part in her father's cold-blooded deed. He pondered the problem. At last, he nodded. He would ride back to Carwell, but the paper would remain in his jumper pocket. He would tell of Rudder's death, lead a posse after the Apache. He would also show the townsfolk the spot from which F. Carson had been shot and explain the impossibility of Del Spreen, a man shorter, even, than himself, committing the murder. This might not clear up the mystery, to everyone's satisfaction, but Del Spreen had no intention of coming back to this part of the country anyway. When the adjutant general saw the confession, it would clear Spreen officially. Then the girl would not be branded, openly, at least, as the daughter of a brutal, callous murderer. She would have no ordeal to face while the O'Bar was being sold. She would carry away no bitter memories to mark her in after years, something like this Ware's kid thought out. He got up again and snapped his fingers to the black stallion, caught the trailing lariat and again threw a hackamore around the black's nose, then vaulted upon it with carbon across his arm. "Reckon she's poor law this way," he reflected. "But she's sure as hell good rangerin." Transcriber's note: this story appeared in the May 1927 issue of Frontier Stories magazine. End of the project. GUTMBRGEBOOKWANTD. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed, creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the Foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark License, especially commercial redistribution. Start. Full license. The full project GUTM-BRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property. Trademark Copyright Agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8. 1B. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. See paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below, 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg, 1E1. The following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the project Gutenberg. Trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9, 1, E3. If an individual project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work, 1, E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with project Gutenberg, 1, E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the project Gutenberg license. 1, E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1, E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9. 1, E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that /he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in section 3 below, 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1. F2. Limited warranty, disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the project. Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the project. Gutenberg Trademark Trademark and any other party distributing a project. Gutenberg Trademark Electronic Work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of merchantability or fitness for any purpose. 1F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit, 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN, or federal tax identification, number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516. Montclair NJ 7042, USA, +1 862 620 19288. Email contact links and up. To date contact information can be found at the Foundation's website, an official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The Foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks.